We are finishing up Numbers chapter 1, and last time we ran out of time before we could do that, and the subject was the tribe of Levi, the Levites. No, it's not Levi, like what you wear, your jeans. Wouldn't it be funny to call those Levies? Nobody have any idea what you're talking about. Anyway, it's the Levites who were assigned to become the priestly tribe of Israel, who would be set apart from this already set apart nation of Israel for their especially holy task. Yet to understand how Levi was set apart is just as critical as the fact that they were set apart. Now, historically and scripturally, the Levites were adopted away from Israel, no longer to be counted as Israelites. They were adopted away en masse from Israel by God. This very much corresponds to the pattern of an earlier surprise adoption that we studied way back in Genesis 48. And I'd like to review that with you for just a moment. So turn your Bibles to Genesis chapter 48. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it's page 55. I'm just going to look at six verses. But it's a very interesting section. Genesis 48, we're going to read verses 1 through 6. A while later, someone told Joseph that his father was ill, and he took with him his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. Now Jacob was told, "Here comes your son Joseph." And Israel gathered his strength, and he sat up in bed. And Jacob said to Joseph, "El Shaddai appeared to me at Luz, in the land of Canaan, and blessed me, saying to me, 'I'll make you fruitful and numerous. I'll make you a group of peoples. I'll give this land to your descendants to possess forever.' Now, your two sons, who were born to you in the land of Egypt, before I came to you in Egypt, are mine. Children born to you, Ephraim and Manasseh, sorry, will be as much mine as Reuben and Simeon are. The children born to you after them will be yours. But for purposes of inheritance, they are to be counted with their older brothers." Here, for some reason that we're not told, Jacob, called Israel, adopts Joseph's two sons away from Joseph. Now recall that Joseph was Jacob's most favored son. And Jacob makes Ephraim and Manasseh, his grandchildren, Joseph's two sons, his own sons. In other words, these two grandchildren of his have their status changed to being Jacob's sons. Now, a strange thing is happening here, and we're left to ponder its meaning. But here in Numbers, we find Yahweh do precisely the same thing to Israel. He adopts away from Israel, remember that's the alternative name for Jacob, the entire tribe of Levi to be his own special servants. So get the picture. Ephraim and Manasseh should have been just clans within the tribe of Joseph. But instead, because they were adopted, they're now elevated from being potential clans into the status of being their own tribes. Two tribes of Israel, Jacob. Levi, on the one hand, is really no longer to be counted as a tribe of Israel. Rather, it's to be removed as a tribe of Israel. Now, on the other hand, they become the tribe of God's priests, so to speak. It's important in deciphering all that happens from this point forward in the Bible, that we recognize and understand the impact of this separateness of Levi from the whole rest of Israel. And here we get an important spiritual principle that completely flies in the face of the modern world. A principle that, if most even understood it, would be denounced as the most intolerant and arrogant position a person could harbor. And it's this: God separates his servant, his worshipers, away from everyone else. He elevates them. He has higher expectations of them and he gives them special attention. They're different. It is Yehovah who gives them the different status. It's not because of anything they've done to merit this kind of favor, but because God has just declared it so. His servants, Levi, are so special, they're not even to be counted as among everybody else of this special set-apart nation, Israel. This all is all connected to this first important God principle that I've ever taught you so long ago. God divides, elects, and separates. He makes distinctions. This is not a God who says, oh, we're just all one big happy family on this earth. No, we're not. He does not view everyone the same, is not tolerant, is not politically correct in order to suit our ever-changing vanities and preferences. Are you a true believer? Are you a disciple of Yeshua? Then that hit song from so many years ago, We Are the World, don't sing it. Doesn't apply to you. You, by the blood of Christ, have been separated away from all other humans. The Lord has given you an elevated status. He's given you special favor. You are the modern equivalent of the Levites. No, you've not become a physical Levite. What did you do? What did any of us do to merit this kind of favor? Nothing. We simply accepted the reality of who Yeshua HaMashiach is and what he did for us. That's what we did. So you, my brethren, you are not to be counted as among the others on this planet. You're not to behave as others among others on this planet. In fact, you have been assigned the duty as guardians of God's holiness here on earth. For you are God's earthly tabernacle. And some mysterious manifestation of his holiness that we call the Holy Spirit, the Ruach HaKodesh, dwells inside of you. Everywhere you are, he is. Everything you experience, you subject him to. And you cause him to react accordingly. Therefore, as God's servant, you are not to join yourself willingly to anyone or anything who's not also set apart for God. You are not to allow anyone or anything who is not set apart for Yehovah to join themselves to you. You've got any control over it. The Levites were set apart for holiness. You're set apart for holiness. That's the deal. And your only real choice, if you don't accept this role and duty, is to renounce your allegiance to Messiah. Now, just as the Levites didn't go off and live entirely separately from the Israelites, we're not to live separately from the world. Yet the Levites were given their own cities among the other tribes of Israel, and that's so they could be near and serve their divine function in helping to shepherd Israel and helping to keep Israel in proper relationship with God. In fact, the Levites not only served God directly at the temple by means of officiating the required sacrifices and other rituals, they served him indirectly by serving Israel. As believers, we are to serve God directly. But as Yeshua said, we're also to serve him indirectly. But how do we do that? Matthew 25, 37 tells us how. Then the righteous will answer him, saying, Lord, when did we ever see you hungry or feed you or thirsty or give you a drink? When did we see you as a stranger and invite you in, or see you naked and clothe you? And when did we see you sick or in prison and come to you? And the king will answer and say to them, truly I say to you, to the extent that you did it to one of these brothers of mine, even the least of them, you've done it to me. We serve him by serving others, especially our brothers and sisters in the faith. But we have to do it his direction. The parallels between the Levites and we disciples of Yeshua, whether Jew or Gentile, are so thorough, so far-reaching, we can't ignore them and then claim to have any real knowledge and understanding of our membership to the kingdom of God. So as we continue our study of Torah, I want you to pay close attention to what God expected of these Levites. Because you know what? Most of those principles apply to you, apply to me. I'm not going to go into detail for the moment, but let me tell you one of the reasons that God separated the Levites from all else on this earth and made them his own. It has to do with the principle that all firstborns automatically belong to him. God set down a principle in Exodus that the lives of the firstborn of everything are his. When he took the lives of all those people and livestock in Egypt, who did he take? The firstborn. Only the firstborn. He was just taking what was already his. The firstborn. But now, with the taking of the Levites away from their biological father, Jacob, the Lord is substituting these Levites as a ransom for all the firstborn of all the other tribes of Israel. Instead of God owning, if you would, the lives of all the firstborn of Israel now, he has exchanged them for the Levites. Just accept that for the moment. I know there's a lot more to explain about it, and in the next few weeks we'll look at that principle in much greater depth. But just take it for what it is for the moment. Let me finish out that thought with another parallel between Levites and believers. The Levites were to protect God's holiness from encroachers. Because if an unauthorized person, somebody God deemed not fit, encroached on God's holiness, the entire community might feel his wrath. And who were deemed as the unfit? All whom God did not deem as holy. The Levites, in protecting God's holiness, at the same time protected the common people of Israel from God's wrath by keeping those who were not sufficiently holy away from him. If the non-holy were able to get near God's holiness, his wrath would fall upon the entire community in divine retribution. Likewise, one of the purposes of believers today is to delay God's wrath upon the unholy, the world. Oh, the day will come when all believers will be whisked away from this earth in an event that the evangelicals call the rapture. And then God's wrath will pour out upon this planet. It's a major part of your purpose as a walking, talking, living, breathing tabernacle of God to protect this world from God's wrath by protecting God's holiness from uncleanness and unholiness of this world. And as long as we're here, he's here. When we're gone, he's gone. Now, if that responsibility that I just told you about doesn't make your knees quake a little bit, your mouth kind of go dry, then you either didn't hear me, didn't believe me, or you just don't get it. that stood between the total annihilation of Israel and God was the Levites. And all that stands today between the total annihilation of the world and God is you. That's it. Now, I don't want to leave this too quickly. Let me explain something to you. The Levites weren't pacifist monks who would plead with an encroacher to stay back, and then if the encroacher paid no heed, the Levites would behave as Gandhi or as a sacrificial lamb. The Levites were armed and dangerous. They immediately killed anyone who encroached too near the holy grounds because they knew better. This wasn't about justice as we think of it. Sympathy was irrelevant. Simple error brought death as quickly as stubborn determination and malicious intent. Remember in Genesis the word picture of the cherubim with their flaming sword, right? That guarded the path into the Garden of Eden? And that any unauthorized person foolish enough to venture too close was immediately destroyed by those cherubim? The Levites were to behave with the cherubim as their example. The Levites didn't ask permission to kill a trespasser. They were expected to do it without hesitation. They didn't arrest an encroacher, take him to the priest and have a hearing. The Levite was obligated to kill that person on the spot or sacrifice their own life for not doing it. God's holiness is that serious of a matter. God indeed places a very high value on human life. But he places the ultimate value on his own holiness. And the scriptures make it clear he'd sacrifice all human life on earth if necessary to maintain his holiness. So as believers, we need to do our job, just as the Levites did theirs. And it was for the benefit of both the worshiper and the pagan. But this job can't be done while we're sitting off on the sidelines. Now, of course, obviously we're not in the business of running around killing unholy people. But as guardians of God's holiness, we are to be active, we're to be watchful, and we're to strike at the true enemy, Satan, whenever he comes too near. And we do this by standing on God's word and by our following him no matter the cost. This must never be a frivolous or rash action on our part, or something we act upon without a lot of prayer and probably some counsel. So with that, let's move now into Numbers chapter 2. Numbers chapter 2. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it's page 146. Page 146. Adonai said to Moses and Aaron, "The people of Israel are to set up camp by clans, and each man with his own banner and under his clan symbol. They are to camp around the tent of meeting, but at a distance. Those camping on the east side, towards the sunrise, are to be under the banner of the camp of Judah. They're to camp according to companies, by tribe and leader. They are as follows: Judah, Nachshon, the son of Amminadav, 74,600. Issachar, Nathaniel, the son of Zuar, 54,400. Zebulun, chief is Eliab, the son of Helon, with 57,400, for a total of 186,400 people. This group is to set out first. Those camping on the south side are to be under the banner of the camp of Reuben, and they are to camp according to companies by tribe and leader. They are as follows: Reuben, the chief is Elitzur, the son of Shedur, with 46,500. Shimon, the chief is Shlemuel, the son of Tzur Shaddai, with 59,300. And Gad, with the chief is Eliasaph, the son of Reuel, 45,650, for a total of 151,450. This group is to set out second. Then the tent of meeting with the camp of the Levites will set out, with the other camps in front and behind. And they'll go in the same order as their camps are set up. Each man will go forward in his position under his banner. Now those camping on the west are to be under the banner of the camp of Ephraim. They're to camp according to companies by tribe and leader. They are as follows. Ephraim, whose chief is Elishama, the son of Amuhud, with 40,500. Manasseh, Gamliel, the chief, the son of Pedahzur, with 32,200. And the tribe of Benjamin, with their chief, Abidan, the son of Gidoni, with 35,400, for a total of 108,100. This group is to set out third. Those camping on the north are to be under the banner of the camp of Dan. They are to camp according to companies by tribe and leader. They are as follows. Dan, with the chief, Achiezer, the son of Amishadai, with 62,700. Asher, the chief, Pagiel, the son of Okran, with 41,500, and Naphtali, with the chief Achira, the son of Enan, with 53,400, for a total of 157,600. This group is to set out last with their banners. These are the ones counted from the people of Israel by clans. The total number recorded in the camp, company by company, was 603,550. But as Adonai ordered Moses, the Levites weren't counted with the rest of Israel. The people of Israel did everything Adonai had ordered Moses. They set up camp under their banners. They set out, each according to his family and clan. Okay, the organizing of the nation of Israel for this coming holy war continues. And the Israelites are given instructions on how they're to set up camp and to deploy when they're at rest. And let's remember that out in the wilderness, the Israelites didn't move all that often. They stayed in one location for many months at a time, years in some cases, before they were led by the Shekinah of the fire cloud to then move again. So when they set up an encampment, it wasn't for a weekend of recreational tent camping. Rather than have some type of a disorganized mess, it was necessary to have order, have structure to this. And the claimed enormity of, 2 to 3 million people meant that the organization and the structure had to be even more precise and codified than if this were just a few people. Now, not surprisingly, a fairly rigid hierarchy is laid out for the Israelites. Now, of utmost importance is that they are to set up this vast tent village around the holy sanctuary that is at the center. A kind of a square formation would be set up with each division consisting of three tribes assigned a particular place. And that place was designated by compass directions, east, west, north, south. Why a square? Why the wilderness tabernacle at the center? Well, despite the obvious reasons that by means of the people surrounding the tabernacle, it was better protected, we also find that historically, Ramses II used this exact formation during his battle campaigns. The royal tent of Pharaoh was placed in the protected middle, and then certain battalions were assigned in a kind of pecking order around that tent. And these Israelites, who had spent generations in Egypt, were completely familiar with this method. Now, I only bring this up to make the point that, generally speaking, God deals with us using manners and ways that we're familiar with in our culture. Most of the rituals God gave to Israel in the form of the laws and the ordinances were presented in even the use of the menorah, of the burnt offerings, of the burning incense, of circumcision and all this. They all had some parallel already long existent in Middle Eastern society. So we mustn't think that God kept up some steady barrage of instructing the Israelites about things and in ways that were completely foreign to them and totally new to the world. Not how it was. There wasn't even any need for this. Centuries of civil customs had been developed. God used many of those imperfect customs for his purposes. For Israel, some of the customs he changed, some he outlawed, some he gave a profoundly different meaning. The point is that most of what Israel did, they did because it was already well known to them. That said, over the centuries following God's ways and better understanding of God's purposes for them, Israel's customs did begin to look very different from all the other folks. Their ways became stranger and stranger to the rest of the world. And indeed, that does appear to be God's plan for his people. We, as Yeshua's disciples, we're to operate in the same way. When we get redeemed, saved, we still live in houses. We still wake up in the morning and go to jobs. We put on shoes and wear clothes. We drive cars. We read newspapers. The speed limits stay the same for us. We still have to pay our taxes. We vote. We continue using electricity. We eat with a knife and a fork. We read books. See, externally, we were saved within the environment and the culture we're familiar with. And usually we'll make our kingdom journey with God inside the culture we're familiar with before we ever submitted to him. And God will also likely send us, most of us, to do his bidding inside the same society that we knew before we were redeemed. And when we're first redeemed, usually all change is internal. It's over time that internal changes begin to show up externally. If it's like in my life, it was a long time. So eventually, we start looking pretty strange to the world. But I'll tell you something, the world starts looking pretty strange to us. Or we start appearing to the world as a threat, their hopes, their aspirations, as we move from merely being perceived as obnoxious to being an enemy. That's how it was for Israel. And if you don't recognize it yet, that's how it is for us now. Verse 2 makes it explicit that the 12 tribes were to camp around the tent of meeting at a distance. It's too dangerous to be too near. And using common phrases of that day, it next says that each Israelite is to camp with his unit, that is, within his battle group, not the badly mistranslated with his standard, as we usually say. So each Israelite is to camp within the battle unit that he belongs to as determined by that census, and above his unit is to fly a banner that represents his unit. Now this banner was some kind of a colored cloth with the insignia of the group emblazoned upon it. Most of the Targums and the Talmud agree that each of these 12 tribes had a distinctive banner incorporating a specific color, and that the color of each banner coincided with one of the 12 semi-precious stones that adorned the high priest's breastplate. Just what each insignia amounted to that was on each banner is anybody's guess. Nothing's been preserved that tells us what they were. So whatever set of symbols for each tribe of Israel that you might see in a book, just guesswork. Now the order of the tribes, or more literally as they're called here, the troops, is that Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun camps together as a unit on the east side. On the east side, the front, if you would, of the wilderness tabernacle. This is the prime position of honor. Judah is the leader of this three-tribe division. Judah obtained this right to lead because Judah replaced Reuben. Remember, Reuben was the natural firstborn of Jacob, but he was replaced due to an indiscretion. Reuben, although he no longer holds the preeminent position as firstborn, and therefore supreme leader of Israel, still is a leader, and apparently second in command to Judah. So he's instructed to camp in the next most prestigious area, which is the south. Let me say here that when I call a tribe by name and say he, that's not to say that the man Reuben, for instance, was still alive. He died long ago. And as we saw in the record of the census, there's now a fellow named Elizur who currently was the head of the tribe of Reuben. The only thing that remained of the original sons of Jacob by this later date was their descendants and their names that continued on as the names of the tribes that they had fathered. So, the leader of the tribe of Judah held the highest status, with the leader of the tribe of Reuben second highest. Reuben camped with Simeon and with Gad, and together those three formed the southern division. Next to the west was Ephraim. He was the head of the division, and it camped together with Manasseh and Benjamin. And lastly, in the least prestigious of all positions, the north, we find that division led by Dan. Those with him were Asher and Naphtali. These camping positions, arranged according to compass directions, also dictated marching order. That is, who marched in the lead, who marched next, so on, down to who brought up the rear. The division of Judah would lead the column. Right after them would come Reuben. Verse 17 tells us that after the division of Reuben, but before the next division, which was Ephraim, the wilderness tabernacle, that's where it was to be carried. That's where it was to fall in. In other words, the Levites, carrying, protecting that all-important tent shrine, were to be smack dab in the middle of this marching column. Bringing up the rear was the division of Dan. Can we ascertain just why certain tribes were designated to camp together in a particular group or division? Yes, there is some rationale and pattern to it. To the east, were composed of what is called the Leah tribes. That is, the biological mother of Judah and the two tribes he camped with was Leah. To the south, we find three more Leah tribes. But there's a difference. The leader of the southern division, Reuben, was the biological son of Leah, as was Simeon, but Gad was not a biological son of Leah. Rather, he was the son of Leah's handmaiden, Zilpah. However, by law, Zilpah as a servant was just a surrogate mother for Leah, so Gad was counted among the sons of Leah. To the west, we have the Rachel tribes, led by Ephraim. That is, all of these were sons produced by Jacob's most beloved wife, Rachel. Now, again, I have some explaining to do because although Benjamin's biological mother was indeed Rachel, Ephraim and Manasseh, the other two tribes making of this division, did not have Rachel as a biological mother. So why are they called the Rachel tribes? Because Rachel was the biological mother of Joseph, who was the biological father of Ephraim and Manasseh. So Joseph's sons, as Joseph's sons, they were currently carrying the authority of Joseph, something that had been ordained by that cross-handed blessing in Genesis 48 that we read to open our lesson today. And by the way, we would think of it, biologically speaking, Ephraim and Manasseh were grandsons of Rachel. Nonetheless, due to the customs of that era, Benjamin was considered a son of Rachel, and in the cross-handed blessing of Jacob, Rachel's husband, had adopted Ephraim and Manasseh. Now, to the north, which is represents the lowest spot in the pecking order. These were the remaining three tribes led by Dan. And what made them the lowest is that they were all sons of Jacob's concubines, Leah's and Rachel's handmaidens. Dan and Naphtali were sons of Bilhah. Asher was a son of Zilpah. Now, what's important to see in all this is that Judah is the lead tribe, had the highest status. Dan was the lowest. We also see that regardless of what we may view as fair, tribalism is brutal in its determination of rank and power, and it was absolute, and it wasn't any different with Israel. The only hope for a lower-ranking tribe was to somehow become more powerful than a tribe of higher rank and to either absorb that higher tribe or just become dominant over it. Keep this in mind as we watch the progress and development of Israel in the Old Testament, because this was the context by which the ebb and flow of power among these tribes occurred. In fact, this is generally how tribal societies work to this day. One other piece of information that I think you'll find helpful understanding the Bible. East was the preeminent direction, just as right is the preeminent side. So understand why the compass directions that the various divisions camped at denoted rank. And we can think of it by beginning east. Picture yourself standing east. I don't know which way I'm facing. But pretend I'm facing east. And I hold out my right arm to my right side. What direction am I pointing to then? South. Therefore, east is rank number one. Immediately to the right, south, rank number two. I turn and I face the south. Hold out my right hand, my right side. I'm pointing now west. That's rank number three. Turn all the way, point that way. Rank number four is north. That's how it worked. That same protocols used throughout the Bible. So you begin with east. You work towards the right to understand rank and order of compass directions, as each of these directions also symbolize rank and order of power and authority. Now let's go on to Numbers chapter 3. This chapter revolves around the census that's taken of the tribe of Levi, only Levi. And it's important to understand that the location where this all took place was at Mount Sinai up to verse 13. But then it switches to a time during their wilderness travels after they loaded up and left Mount Sinai. That begins in verse 14. Okay? That's the dividing point between 13 and 14. So let's read Numbers chapter 3. You have a complete Jewish Bible, page 147. These are the descendants of Aaron and Moses as of the day when Adonai spoke with Moses on Mount Sinai. The names of the sons of Aaron are Nadav, the firstborn, Avihu, Eleazar, and Ithamar. These are the names of the sons of Aaron, the priest, whom he anointed and ordained as Kohanim, as priests. But Nadav and Avihu died in the presence of Adonai when they offered unauthorized fire before Adonai in the Sinai desert, and they had no children. Eleazar and Ithamar served as priests in the presence of Aaron, their father. And Adonai said to Moses, "Summon the tribe of Levi and assign them to Aaron the priest so that they can help him. They are to carry out his duties and the duties of the whole community before the tent of meeting and performing the service of the tabernacle. They are to be in charge of all the furnishings of the tent of meeting, and to carry out all the duties of the people of Israel connected with the service of the tabernacle. Assign the Levites to Aaron and his sons. Their one responsibility in regard to the people of Israel is to serve him. You are to appoint Aaron and his sons to carry out the duties of the priests, and anyone else who involves himself, be put to death. And Adonai said to Moses, I have taken the Levites from among the people of Israel in lieu of every firstborn male that is first from the womb among the people of Israel. So the Levites are mine. All the firstborn males belong to me. Because on the day that I killed all the firstborn males in the land of Egypt, I separated for myself all the firstborn males in Israel, both animal and human. They're mine. I'm Adonai. And Adonai said to Moses in the Sinai Desert, take a census. Excuse me. Take a census of the tribe of Levi by clans and families, count every male a month old or over. Moses counted them in the manner Adonai had said, as had been ordered, and the names of the sons of Levi were Gershon, Kohath, and Merari. The names of the sons of Gershon were Libni and Shimi. They fathered their respective clans. Likewise, the sons of Kohath, Amram, Yitzhar, Hebron, and Uziel, and the sons of Merari, Mahli, and Mushi. These fathered the clans of the Levites. Gershon fathered the clans of Libni and Shimni. These were the Gershon clans. Of them, 7,500 males a month old and over were counted. The Gershon clans were to camp behind the tabernacle, towards the west. The chief of the Gershon clan was Eliasaph, the son of Lael. And in connection with the tent of meeting, the descendants of Gershon were to be in charge of the following: the tabernacle itself, its inner and outer coverings, the screen for the entrance of the tent of meeting, the curtains surrounding the courtyard, the screen for the entrance of the courtyard surrounding the tabernacle and the altar, all the fixtures and ropes for these items and their maintenance. Kohath fathered the clans of Amram, Yitzhar, Hebron, and Uziel. These were the Kohath clans. Of them, 8,600 males, a month old and over, were counted. They were in charge of the holy place. The Kohath clans were to camp next to the tabernacle towards the south. The chief of the Kohath clans was Elitzaphan, the son of Uziel. They were responsible for the ark, the table, the menorah, the altars, the utensils the priests use when they serve in the holy place, the curtain, everything involved with the maintenance of these things. Eleazar, the son of Aaron the Cohen, was first among the chiefs of the Levites and supervised those who were in charge of the holy place. Merari fathered the clans of Mahli and Mushi. These were the Merari clans. Of them, 6,200 males a month old and over were counted. The chief of the Merari clan was Zuriel, the son of Avichail. They were to camp next to the tabernacle towards the north. The Merari clans were assigned responsibility for the frames of the tabernacle, along with its crossbars, posts, sockets, and fittings, together with their maintenance. Also the posts of the surrounding courtyard with their sockets, pegs, and ropes. Those who were to camp in front of the tabernacle on the east, in front of the tent of meeting towards the sunrise, were Moses, Aaron, and his sons, who were in charge of the holy place. They carried out their responsibility on behalf of the people of Israel, and anybody else who involved himself was to be put to death. The total number of Levites, whom Moses and Aaron counted by their clans, all the males a month old and over, was 22,000. Adonai said to Moses, register all the firstborn males of the people of Israel a month old and over, and determine how many of them there are. Then you are to take the Levites for me, Adonai, in place of all the firstborn among the people of Israel, and the cattle of the Levites in place of the firstborn of the cattle belonging to the people of Israel. And Moses counted, as Adonai had ordered him, all the firstborn among the people of Israel. The total number of firstborn males registered, a month old and over, of all those who were counted was 22,273. And Adonai said to Moses, take the Levites in place of all the firstborn among the people of Israel, and the cattle of the Levites in place of their cattle. The Levites are to belong to me. Adonai, since there were 273 more firstborn males from Israel than there were male Levites, in order to redeem them, you are to take 5 shekels from each of these, using the sanctuary shekel, and give the redemption money for these extra people to Aaron and his sons. Moses took the redemption money from those who were over and above those redeemed by the Levites. The amount of money he took from the firstborn of the people of Israel was 1,365 shekels using the sanctuary shekel. Moses gave the redemption money to Aaron and his sons in keeping with what Adonai had said, as Adonai had ordered Moses. Biblically speaking, genealogy is always important. And so the first verses of chapter 3 serve to elaborate on the genealogy of Moses and Aaron, but mainly of Aaron. Actually, other than the fact that Moses is Aaron's brother, none of the genealogy posted here applies directly to Moses. Now, let me reiterate a principle that can get a little bit confusing, but it's essential to our understanding of the social structure of Israel, so it's worth repeating. Aaron and his family were just one of several clans that formed the tribe of Levi. Even though there were several Levite clans, God assigned Aaron's clan with a special holy status that was a notch above all the other members of the tribe of Levi. All the other Levites were there to be servants. They were there to help the priests. Or perhaps more accurately, they were servants to the priesthood. See, priests were the only ones who could conduct the rituals and ceremonies as servants of God. The other Levite families had different duties. They did things like guarding the tabernacle, carrying it around, filling up those water basins, cleaning up the mess, stoking the fires, playing music, singing psalms, all that. So somewhat like the Levites were removed for service to God from the regular family of Israel, all the other tribes, the family of Aaron was removed from the regular family of Levi, and they were given an elevated status for the most special service to God. Now, as for the high priest, and there was only one high priest this time, Aaron, he was to come from one specific son of Aaron in the future, Eleazar. So the tribe of Levi was removed from Israel for tabernacle service. The family of Aaron was removed from the Levites for priestly service. And from the family of Aaron, one specific son was to provide the ongoing line of high priests, dividing, separating, electing. In verse 2, we get the names of Aaron's sons and a very sad reminder of the fate of two of them. The 4 sons are Nadav, Avihu, Eleazar, and Ithamar. Nadav was the firstborn from Aaron. He would, under normal circumstances, have been the next high priest after his father Aaron died. And then Nadav would have produced the line from which all future high priests would have come from. But Jehovah killed Nadav and his brother Avihu in direct retaliation for their offering of strange or alien fire to the Lord. That is, they were performing their priestly duties, but they ignored direct instructions about some ritual procedures, so the Lord engulfed them in flames and burned them up right before their father Aaron's eyes. And since Aaron's firstborn, Nadav, was dead, and his secondborn, Avihu, was also dead, it next fell to Eleazar as the next in line to be the future father of Israel's high priests. Further, it makes it clear that Nadav and Avihu's bloodlines died out with them. They had no sons at the time. Their family trees were cut down. Their lines ended. Well, the next few verses, beginning with verse 5, defines the duties of the Levites, meaning the non-priests. And if you read this in English, it gets a little bit hazy as to exactly what they're supposed to do. Most texts say something to the effect, they shall perform duties. They will do the work of the tabernacle. They'll do duty on behalf of the Israelites. Stuff like that. In fact, the Hebrew makes all these duties very specific. In verse 7, what is usually translated as simply to perform duties is in Hebrew, shamar mishmeret. And it means keep guard. Pretty specific. So verse 7 ought to read, they, the Levites, shall keep guard for him and for the whole community before the tent of meeting. And as we discussed earlier, one of the primary assignments of the Levites were as guards of God's holiness and of his dwelling place. Later on in that same verse, where most translations say, doing the work of the tabernacle or something like that, the Hebrew used for doing the work is abad bodah. And this actually means doing heavy work. So the first duties assigned to the Levites are to shamar mishmeret, keep guard, and then to abad bodah, do the heavy work of the tabernacle. Verses 9 and 10 essentially put across the idea that the Levites are dedicated to do the blue-collar tasks associated with the tabernacle, and they're to follow the directions of the priests. Verse 11 begins a fascinating divine instruction that is almost lost to both Christianity and Judaism. This is an instruction that I stated to you last week, and I told you we get into a little bit more later, and here we are. And the instruction takes place in verses 11 through 13. It is that the Levites are to replace the firstborn of all the other tribes of Israel. That is, whereby God, in some special way, regarded all the firstborn males of the tribes of Israel as special and set apart for him, kind of ownership or adoption by God, now he takes all the Levites, all of them, no matter what they are, in total, for his own, as a substitute for all the firstborns of Israel. That special status of Israelite firstborns as over and above the firstborns of other nations came about in Exodus 11. When the firstborns of Israel were commemorated to God as a remembrance of the Passover. Now we're going to begin next week by discussing the replacement of the firstborn of Israel by the tribe of Levi.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning, products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.